there is to say, did it was, what impact did your design and did your work for the optical system have in other firms?
I don't think any, and finally the other firms caught up with us.
Right.
We had a couple of years or something, I think we could do stuff. And especially this took form, Fairchild was aimed for the digital world. Certainly, in the first transistors they were making with digital circuits, and I felt at the time that the world was going to would be an analog world. Again, I was decades ahead of myself because now there's a lot of analog circuitry being made, but I felt, you know, with the idea that you have to take an analog signal and then digitize it, and then at the other end get it back to an analog form. That if you can make circuits on an analog basis, it made a lot more sense. And we made some really great operational amplifiers. I look back in awe at some of those early circuits we made. And we sold a lot of them. They went to some unknown bottomless pit with a Westinghouse plant in Maryland. So,
yeah,
I never knew the end use, but we made a lot of them, and they were very. And for some of the Teledyne contracts, we could envision very large arrays, you know, 20 devices at a 20 circuits at a time that you could interconnect somewhere or another. The IHOS program was one that we made a lot of prototype things where, in one flat package, we'd have 20. Sophisticated integrated circuits, and we figured out how to hitch them up and stack them, and I was working on multi-layer ceramics, where you have ceramics of metal layer in between that you could use to stack these things. And that turned into the world's most unsuccessful potato chip factory. We could never solve the problems of keeping them flat enough. So that was a disaster, but we tried. And I would realize that in fancy packaging, the Japanese were way ahead of us, and I couldn't get Americans to bid on this stuff. So I went to Kyoto and met a small company that was just starting up called Kyocera. And they had one little plant there outside of Kyoto. Inamori was running it, and this turned into, you know, the ones that was the packaging company. And I went there on a Saturday afternoon, and he said, "Do you want to see our plant? It's about, you know, 20 minutes outside of Kyoto." And I said, "What's to see on a Saturday afternoon?" And he said, "This is just another day for us." That was a really energetic company. He broke all the Japanese rules.
In what sense?
Rising by seniority rather than merit. All this kind of stuff. The way you marketed stuff. You didn't go through these various multi-layer trading companies. And I learned then that you never ask a Japanese manufacturer, "Can he make something?" Because that would be... he would feel ashamed if he said, "No, he can't make it." So I'd read enough books on Japan. I said, the way to phrase this is, "I know this is a product that you can make. If you would honor me with bidding on it, I'd be happy to receive the bid." You know, if the bid came, he could make it, and if it didn't come, he couldn't. But I wasn't confronting
him.
I learned a lot of things like that. But the Japanese, as far as all of the... advanced packaging that took place at Teledyne, I was able to get Inamori's help on. And I had no dream he was going to end up taking setting up a plant in San Diego and taking over this whole thing. And he was a real go-getter. God.
I'm just reviewing my list of questions here.
But one thing, a steady problem was you know, being underfinanced.
Mm-hmm.
And I once in a while write a bad payroll checks on Friday, because I learned quickly you can't delay a payroll check. I'm giving it out after lunch rather than before lunch on Friday is a disaster.
Right.
And I learned that once. Mm. The hard way, but after that I always write it, and I said, well, maybe I hope enough stuff comes in over the weekend, or I go to the bank and grovel or whatever it took, but I did that.
And that was because of financial problems with the parent?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I just said, I can't take this anymore, and I just got up out of my office and went to the airport and got on the first plane to L.A. and just stormed into Singleton's office. If I need $100,000 right now to keep this thing going, and you said you're going to support this thing, and now I'm here, I need it. And he mumbled something to Betty Denton, his secretary, and she came back in 10 minutes with a check for $60,000. He said, I'm giving you $60,000 rather than $100,000 because that's all the money there is in this whole goddamn company. this very great Texas accent he had is a big help on discussions like that. But he did what he could do, and we did what we could do. But as I said, this fundamental goal difference presented steady problems.
Between the broader markets the sort of internal markets.
Yeah, and so we developed a lot of broad-based products, just standard, the standard transistor line to meet this, and at which point we started getting some conflict with Fairchild.
Mm-hmm.
And that was never major.
Conflict or competition?
Well, Teledyne had patents on this stuff that we didn't.
Oh, right.
And at one point, Noyce approached me and said, you know, you got to take a license on this stuff. And I said, I'm not terribly inclined to, but it got to the level where the lawyers got involved, and so Singleton came up for a meeting with Noyce for lunch. We sat there and had a very cordial lunch, and at the end of which we had been just talking around this subject, and Singleton turned to Noyce and said, you know, one thing I really believe in is our patent system and the value of owning patents. He said, but in your particular case, I don't think your patents are worth a good goddamn, and I will personally go back and find prior art that blows your patents out of the water if you give us any more trouble on this. And Noyce was just flabbergasted. That's the last I ever heard of any patents and problems. These are amusing things to think back through, and I think I remember them fairly accurately. I might play funny tricks, but I certainly know that one happened roughly in that way. I'm going to take a break.
Okay, sure.
Minute.
Yeah. We were talking about the problem of the underfinancing,
mm-hmm.
really, and so I suppose I had understood that initially your strategy was really for the Imelco division to provide products to the systems division.
Yeah.
Was it partly because of this funding problem that you started to address the broader?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And I should have seen it earlier that you can control your own destiny if you're making your own money, but if you're depending on somebody else,
right,
largesse to do this, it's not going to ever work out, no matter how much lip service is paid to doing that. And to tell that was run very lean, and George Kosmetsky, who was working with Singleton, was really something else as far as doing trivial things that would save a lot of, save some money.
For example?
He said, you can only check out one pencil at a time from the storeroom. And somebody recounted that they went to Kosmetsky once, who had the bad habit of chewing on pencils. And he said, so I can only take out one pencil at a time, and you're sitting there eating the goddamn thing. But so Kosmetsky and Singleton eventually was a conflict of egos, and George left. But to his credit, the day, first day I met him, that famous New Year's Eve meeting, he said, this is not my long term, what I want to do with my life is I want to go and run a business school eventually. He said, I'm going to do this for a while. And he did, and went down to run the University of Texas business school.
And he knew it at that time.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he said, so I went down there, and they had all these deans, you know, scattered around. They all had their own Xerox machines. So I just put all these guys in a bullpen outside my office. That was George's approach to. But he was a very quick study, and just did it. And he could remember numbers. I said, George, wouldn't you be happy if everybody's called by their social security number? And he said, oh, yes, of course. He'd come back from Washington and say, George told me this. And I said, George, well, he couldn't remember. But I would go back to Washington and give technical talks to dealerships or wherever it was. And the next week he'd get up and he'd give my talk. He just remembered all this stuff, and was very quick thinking, and he had a bad habit of bidding on stuff there's no, we didn't have a ghost of a chance of making. But it was all, we said we couldn't, and then we did.
And so he was doing a lot of sales work, if you will.
He was be in Washington for a month straight
sometimes. Right. Who were the big competitors at this time for, I guess it was IBM, would be...
Well, for what we were doing, it was the Litton that Singleton had come from, and the inertial guidance systems. He'd hired some very talented people, Joe Sneed and Tech Wilson, and Art Holman, I guess. But these were great systems.
Right.
People. And then we were just competing with the general run of whoever bid on government contracts, depending on the particular product. But as the company grew, the systems company was a smaller and smaller part of the whole conglomerate that was being put together.
And was that a conglomerate, I mean, with the comment about that we talked about earlier of Singleton saying, you know, he wants to make another GE, was that conglomerate model at all explicit in the early days?
Not in the early day. He was acquiring companies, and he said we have to acquire pretty second-rate companies because we can't afford anything else. And but the acquisitions came in slowly, and the only division that was started from scratch was the systems company and the Amelco division. The rest were all acquisitions and combining various things after they were acquired.
Right.
And this Harvard analysis of that is just spectacular.
Well, I'll have to really have to get a hold of that.
Yeah, and pointing out that as our stock started taking off in the market, it was a high PE stock, and we could buy like a founder or something, a very low PE company. You take a company that has a PE of 6 fitting into a company with a PE of 30, and you don't, after it gets in there, you don't know it, and its PE turns into 30. So Singleton really thought this through. and then he started acquiring, so the money's an insurance company, so, and the insurance companies were cheap then, and he bought a bunch of those, and gave, which gave him access to vast amounts of the money to invest.
Hmm.
So he was really had thought this through. He was a master chess player.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd play blindfolded chess and with groups.
And would just remember where the placement of all the pieces. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there was one time he was playing, I think, chess with Tech Wilson, and Tech made some comment, and Henry looked puzzled and said, "Hey, you told me the wrong move 3 moves back." And Tech had.
That's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to know Claude Shannon, who was on the board of Teledyne.
Oh, really? I hadn't realized that. Had Singleton worked with him?
Yeah, they worked. They worked together at MIT, and had a very close personal relationship.
Huh.
And Singleton's wife, Carolyn, told me that they'd get together and play chess around the clock with a timer. He said it was just like the Chinese water torture here in this. this thing going off all the time, and she said once they quit on a Sunday night, and they were taking a subway uptown, and they got separated on the subway, and Singleton said, "You know, we've been playing chess so long, I could figure out what stop this guy was going to meet me at," which he did. So, but Shannon was just a brilliant guy, and he just fell between two disciplines where they give Nobel Prizes, or he would have certainly have won it. But he wasn't comfortable in large groups, and we'd have Teledyne meetings, and they'd put me next to Claude because he and I could yuck about one thing or another that we enjoyed. And so I got to know him fairly well. He's a really amazing guy. But Singleton once said, "I want a technical guy on the board, and I know when companies get larger, it's hard to put them on, so I'll do it right at the start."
And did he stay on? Did Shannon stay on for
a while? He was on for a decade or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Art Rock was on the board, so as far as the board interaction goes, I don't know much about it, but I know Art certainly knows that stuff.
Mm. What, and think about this period, sort of the 62 period. Were you doing a lot of active recruiting of people from Fairchild, from other
Fairchild,
companies?
TI, got a lot of people from TI. Other companies. John was very good at persuading Fairchild people to join us.
And was did you find it fairly easy at that time with the your reputations for the
good reputation, and the company grew. We had close to 1,000 people there, so it was a major company. By then we were pretty self-supporting and had all this product stuff. But John had a run-in with Kosmetsky and left.
In this around 62, 63?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I know, to this day, I know practically nothing about it. I just know that John quit in a huff. And Singleton felt real bad about that and said, "If I had gotten involved, this wouldn't have happened." But I don't know the details to this day.
Did it happen very abruptly?
Yeah.
Then?
And John had a steady career thing after that. It was happening every 3 years. He'd storm out of someplace and start something else.
And then he went on to found a semiconductor works for Union Carbide?
Yeah, he did that, and then he left that and started Intercell and a couple more. Probably about 4 of them.
Mm.
So we were business competitors for the first time.
Mm.
And something that I recounted when I delivered a eulogy of my close attachment to him, was that there was in the mountain range east of Inyo Valley in California, there's a valley called the Saline Valley, and in between there's a mountain peak that goes up to about 10,000 feet from not much above sea level. And John and I, our goal was to climb that from the Saline Valley side.
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom, it's hot desert, and at the top, it's freezing.
Mm-hmm.
So the only time you could do it was at the time of the full moon in May. And John and I had tried this 2 years and failed, but we felt we knew how to do it from that point on. And John quit just about 2 weeks before we were going to take this climb. And the relations were very frosty on the business level.
Mm-hmm.
But John and I said, we're good friends, let's put that beside and take this climb. And we made it to the top, and we got hit with a horrible, horrible cold front that came in. And we had traveled up pretty light to get there. So John and I had to lie there and hold each other all night to keep from freezing. And the next morning we went back and got in the barrel again with the lawyers. So it just shows the mixed relations that I have. And John, it was sort of his... Well, it was way with a lot of people. It was a love-hate relationship. They were real angry at him one time, but he turned into a real charmer the next.
One thing we haven't talked much about to this point is the developing sort of technical and business culture and community on the peninsula. In the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, and what that was like. A lot of ink has been spilled about the genesis of the sort of Silicon Valley business culture and tracing it back to this period, or high technology business even. And
yeah, well, there's too much technology, usually for one company to absorb, or too many ideas, and there were spin-offs. So you've probably seen these flow charts of spin-offs from Fairchild. There's about 200 companies on there, just a vast number. That was happening every place. And people, by then, venture capitalists were getting involved, and the whole climate changed in the early days, where you just wanted to make something until you wanted to make a lot of money doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The emphasis turned more onto the business model, and there was no stigma to failing.
By the early 60s?
Well, say mid 60s. Uh-huh. I don't know. It's one of those time periods. But if you failed, then you just went and got some more money and did try it again. So there was a steady influx of venture money.
Mm-hmm. And
for the semiconductor industry as a whole, it'd be quite a bit later than that. I tried to trace out the investment in the semiconductor industry from the start of Fairchild through like the mid or late 60s.
Mm.
And I rapidly concluded that more money was going in than was coming out.
Really?
For that whole decade, it was just same thing is happening now in other areas. Nanotechnology is money will just flow into this and nothing's going to come out. But that was true of the transistor. There were a couple of notable successes. Fairchild was coining money for a long time there.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of these other startups, they raise money and not make that much or get bought out by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting phenomenon that and you were dealing with an investment community that didn't know a semiconductor from a piece of Swiss cheese, so that didn't help.
Right.
There was no technical appreciation for the most part of these things.
Right. What of the sort of informal information exchange and news networks, in the community, in the technical community around semiconductors. Well, you know, for example, a lot has been written about these different bars.
Yeah, that was a very active social thing. Every Friday night, those of us that were so inclined to get together, and the other guys you had worked with, or were still working with, or would work with sometimes. It was a very friendly, not especially competitive environment.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was young and liked each other, and it was a lot of fun.
Do you think in part that was due to this technological abundance?
I think so.
Yeah.
And so, no, that hasn't been discussed in much detail, I don't think. But
no.
But it was just like the resources of the U.S. We could always expand by going west or something. Here you could expand by starting a new company, and people weren't that concerned about you leaving because they had more on their plate than they could deal with anyhow. So it just grew. But Fairchild was spawning off all sorts of companies, most of which failed, but they turned into the industry leaders in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. In 1962, as Imelco starts to get more into the commercial products, I guess, they're very early, well, you were very early in producing field effect transistors,
yeah.
Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Who were you competing against in that area at the time?
There was hardly any competition, which John, who had always been fascinated by field effect transistors, realized that this was a niche market for a high impedance device rather than a low impedance device.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a good market if we could make them, which we did. That was a good source of income for a long time.
Mm. Was that... And with the bipolar transistors, where you were competing against lots of other
people. Yeah, well, then it was just having a broad enough product line, and our salesman had some ammunition to go in and could take a broad-based order, right?
Okay.
Trying to sell one or two products.
Mm-hmm.
Dizzy Haas was instrumental in getting a lot of that stuff put together.
The bipolar.
Well, just getting a product line and figuring out what products we could make easily, and how much of this was just a different number with the same device in it, and
mm-hmm.
slight ways of sorting the devices to do this. So we turned into a pretty broad-based company.
So in just the space of 2 years, you were up to like 1,000?
Oh, no, it wasn't that fast.
Oh, okay.
I guess 1,000 would have occurred in 64 or 65. They say Christoph has... can fill in some of that numbers that mm-hmm. I've got in boxes down the cellar,
right.
but he's been through that stuff.
But it was a fairly rapid growth, nevertheless.
Mm-hmm. It was a steady growth. With all of these semiconductor companies, including Fairchild, there was always a down period. You know, it was never a steady upward thing. It would drop precipitously and then go back up.
Mm-hmm.
And right after we built our new plant, we had a first general layoff. And
in this early 60s period.
Yeah. But then it picked up again a few months later. And it's never been a steady market. It's either ups or downs. And sort of watering a delicate flower with a fire hose or something.
And how did the competition between Union Carbide Electronics and Imelco play out?
There was never any major competition.
Okay.
John went on and did other things.
Right.
And I for a period I sort of saw very little of him. He was doing his thing and I was doing mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally got more interested in European things. He was spending a lot of time in Europe with the Swiss watch industry and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
He moved to Idaho, so it was many years I saw very little of him. Later in his life, I saw a lot of more of him again.
Mm-hmm.
And I, we were sitting, he was pretty ill, and he and I were sitting talking about some of these old days, and his wife came and said, "Oh, God, you guys should have a tape recorder on."
Mm-hmm.
She could just see the stuff that was being said then, that war was lost forever now.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll all make up for it.
As best we can.
And at least when there's only one person recounting it, you don't get conflicting
consistency. If not accuracy. In some of the materials that Christoph did provide me, I saw that it seemed that a big success for both the Melco division and for Telfeldine more broadly, I suppose, was this concept.